look forward to this event, having Dr. Beverly come and speak to us. We're going to get right into that. He is Professor of Ethics and Theology at Tyndale. Most of you know that. He's also the Associate Director of the Institute for the Study of American Religion in Santa Barbara, California. And if you're going to be the director of anything, Santa Barbara, California is the place to be it. He's had a number of health issues recently, and I was just so glad that he was able to come and share to us tonight. He's got a number of books that he'll talk to you about, worthwhile reading. I hope all of you will. And you don't hear me say that all the time when people have their stuff, but I hope all of you will pick up good resources that will stand you in good stead. I've read a number of his books. Long time down the road, you'll be appreciating them. Would you welcome Dr. James Beverly?
Well, folks, I know that Don mentioned this morning that I've had some health issues. I can truly say I'm probably happy to be here with anybody. Because on Monday I went for a regular test at a clinic, and they did a cardiogram, and then they sent it to a specialist. And he said, there's something really wrong here. I'm not going to take any chances. I don't know what's going on, but you're going by ambulance to another, to a hospital. And so that's that was a great signal to me that life can change quickly. Yeah. 2 years ago, I had spinal surgery, so it was January 4th, I had spinal surgery, and then Monday found out that things are in trouble. One of the first things I thought about when I got to Mount Sinai was wonder if I'll be speaking at Cedarville on Sunday night. Things didn't look good for a while. I was in the going up in an elevator to get an echocardiogram. He stopped at the floor, and an orderly with a patient on the bed outside the elevator said, my patient's on life support. Can we have the elevator? And the doctor who was with me said, no, this guy's in bad shape too. First they talked about maybe need for surgery right away, because I think they suspected, they suspected clogged arteries and a leaky aortic valve, but it turns out I just have a leaky aortic valve, so they let me out on Friday. Anyway, it's great to be with you and to think about the basic health, truth or fiction. As most of us know, the novel, still in heart, ever coming out in paperback soon. The novel is the best-selling adult fiction of all time. And the movie's coming out May 19th with Tom Hanks. They spent $100 million making the movie. There's no indication that they're going to back away from all the wild things that the novel says. So what I want to do tonight is share with you for a while about Vincent Cope. Will use the PowerPoint, and then we'll have questions. Okay? So the first thing I want to... just before we look at this lecture, I'll say a word about my books. I wrote a required Vincent Cope called Counterfeit Code. You don't have to have read the novel to understand my book. In fact, if you get this book, you'll know more than most people in the world about the claims of the Vincent Cope. You'll be able to respond to your neighbors and friends and business people who are talking about the novel. And then my latest book is a book called Religions A to Z, which talks about 100 different religions. And then there's a book on internal blessing, and then I brought one of my three books on the law called Christ and the Lord. So those are available after, and they will be helpful to you. I also brought some pamphlets that I've written on different topics. Okay, let's think about some introduction points about the Da Vinci Code. So the first one, we'll wait for the slide to change. Here's something I learned from the first time I spoke. I have to tell people what I think is obvious. I don't hate Dan Graham. Okay? One of the first times I spoke in New Mexico, I got an email from somebody and he said, it's obvious you hate him. No, I don't hate him at all. I watched almost every interview he's ever given. He seems like a really nice guy. I think you'll be amazed to find this out. He claims to be a Christian. Now, we'll see in a minute. Some of his ideas I don't think are taught in any Sunday school, in any church, anywhere. And he really thinks his views are compatible with the gospel. I don't think they are. I think they destroy the gospel. Okay, another introductory point. I do care about evidence and being open-minded. Some of the people who write to me, especially after I was on 100 Hendrick Street last summer, say things like, you're just a nerd. You don't get out much. you're a closed-minded person. But I do care about evidence and being open-minded. I don't want to examine things. I've studied with people in different religions. I've studied with one of the world's leading atheists, Anthony Flew. So I do get out of debt. I was raised very conservative, Baptist, from Moncton, New Brunswick, raised in a little country Baptist church, and we had a pretty simple view of reality. It's basically Baptist. Now, you can be saved if you're something else. You're just like second class. I won't tell you some of the nasty things I was taught when I was a kid about people in other groups. It helped me immensely that my uncle and aunt, who lived two doors from me, joined the Pentecostal church. Because they were two of the most godly people I've ever met. In fact, my brother and I used to go over to their farmhouse, and we would go in while they were having the morning devotion. They read the Bible so much that their Bibles were baked in two practically. Turning the pages so much. So that was a lesson to me that God might be bigger than the Baptist church sometimes thinks. Let's go on. Here's a third point. Yeah. Now, let me tell you about books. In Canada, if you sell 3,000 copies of a book, you've written a bestseller. So one of my books on Islam sold 20,000 copies in 4 years. Now, here's the difference between me and Dan Graham. That book means, on average, I did the math, it sells 30 copies a day. This book sells 30,000 copies a day.
Yeah.
But you can help even the odds. All right, let's go to the next point. Why all this fuss about the Da Vinci Code? Why are we here tonight thinking about this? Let's look at some answers. First, the novel claims to be more than a novel. In fact, you won't understand all the fuss until you realize this. It's not just a work of fiction. Let's look at the next slide. Here's what it says. Page 1. All descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. That's why there's a fuss. If Dan Graham would take that claim out of the novel, the debates would go away, but he's yet to admit there's any mistakes in anything he's written. Let's go on. If the novel's true, the claims about Christianity, every church should shut down because we've messed it up so bad. Let's look at the next slide. Is Jesus the Son of God? Did Jesus perform miracles? Are the Gospels reliable? Is the Gospel worth preserving? The novel says no to those four questions. Now, folks, I study more than most people about why there's different religious groups, why there's different denominations. And it can be very depressing studying all the different groups. Do you know how many types of Pentecost there are in the United States? There's about 400 different Pentecostal groups. And if you pick other denominations, it's as sad. And sometimes they fight over trivial stuff, things that aren't that important. what we need to do is we defend faces, and faith is thinking important faith. So if this novel teaches, as it does, that Jesus is not the Son of God, he didn't perform miracles, the Gospels are not reliable, and the Gospel has not been preserved in the Christian church, it's been distorted by the church, well then we've got trouble on it. Now some people say, it's just a novel. No, it's a novel that in its teaching denies the basics of Christian faith. And therefore we have a right to complain. I don't think we should fight Dan Brown on the issue of liberty. It's a free world, at least in the West, and he should be allowed to teach what he wants, and he should be allowed to reply. Alright, let's go on. The novel also teaches this really weird idea. That worship, true Christian worship, is about sex ritual in church. The novel actually teaches that Jews in the Old Testament and Christians in the New Testament, what they actually did was go to synagogue church and take their clothes off and have fun. Now, I don't know about you, but I've been reading the Bible since I was a child. And I don't recall reading anything like that in the Old or New Testament. I don't recall the New Testament telling us that true worship is go to church and take your clothes off. Now, there are groups that do that in our world. There's always been groups that do that. But not Jews and not Christians. But that's what Dan Brown says. Now, I actually think Dan Brown, remember, he claims to be Christian. He says this is what true Christianity is. I actually wrote him a letter in the back of my book, and what I said to him was, Dave, you can't possibly believe that. If you really believe that, is that what you hope your wife does for worship? Is that what you hope your family and friends do? See, he can't possibly live with his theories. So this is another reason the novel's controversial. Let's go on. The novel also has new and strange ideas about history. Now, new and strange doesn't mean false, but this novel teaches so many wild theories that it almost self-destructs because it teaches so many weird things. Okay, let's go on. Here's an example. Here's some examples. Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene. Let's look at the list first and then we'll think about it. Mary moved to France after Jesus was crucified. They had a child. We even know the child's name according to the novel, Sarah. And then the bones of Mary Magdalene have been protected all these years by a secret society. It's now the duty of a Christian who wants to defend the faith to know about a secret society called the Prodigal Son. Before I read this novel, I'd never heard of the Prodigal Son, and then when I wrote the book, I had to do research on it. And then the novel says the secret society was started in 1099 in Jerusalem, and it was headed by Leonardo da Vinci, the famous artist. That's why the novel is called the Da Vinci Code. Now, folks, these are strange ideas. Now, the first one isn't that strange, that Jesus was married. However, the New Testament doesn't say Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene. What it says about her is that she was a disciple. And it says about seven other things. It never says she was married. Even the Gnostic Gospels, which were written much later than the New Testament, don't say that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married. All the rest of the stuff, I don't know a single historian in the entire world who believes this stuff. But Dan Brown thinks he's discovered these secret truths that historians are basically ignored or don't know about because they've been stuck in a rut. Alright, let's go on. The novel even claims stuff that's kind of intriguing. It says the National Library in Paris, that library is called the Bibliothèque Nationale, discovered documents about this ancient society. You know, when a book claims that, you sort of feel like a loser. You go, I don't even know how to say it. I've never been to Paris, and oh well, what do I know? I'm just a dumb Christian. Okay, let's go on. The novel also claims to know the answer to this: how many panes of glass at the front entrance of the Louvre, the famous museum in Paris? There's three typical answers. 643-666-684. Now, if you were writing a novel and wanted to help sales, what would you hope the answer
be?
B. Ta-da! Now, because I had spinal surgery, I'll never personally study this topic, because my neck doesn't bend enough to go look at the entrance to the loom and count the number of panes of glass. We'll come back to that in a bit later. Let's go on. Where did these ideas come from? In a way, what happened to Dan Brown is what happens to all of us when we go outside of our area of specialty. My wife warns me, for example, like she knows if I go to study a cult group or a new religion or a world religion, I'm going to do okay, because that's what I'm trained to do. But she knows I'm dangerous in a mall. When I go shopping, I forget to test the spirits. I believe anything anybody tells me. So if my wife was here tonight, she would tell you, the times I've come home with deals, you know, the best deal ever struck on towels, etc. And she'll often have to tell me that I wasn't careful enough. Dan Brown is a novelist. He's not a scholar of religion. He's not a Bible scholar. He's not a scholar of history. He's not an art scholar. But I think he got fooled because he ran into some ideas that he thought were true. Where did he get the ideas? Let's look. From this 1982 bestseller, Holy Blood, Holy Grail. This was the book that shocked the world 20-some years ago, by saying that Jesus and Mary were married and there's secret documents about the bones of Mary Magdalene. And Sarah's, remember Jesus and Mary were married and had a child named Sarah? Sarah's children, according to this book and Dan Brown's novel, Sarah's children became the kings of France. Alright? So that's what this novel said and then contributed to Dan Brown. And where did the authors of this book get their ideas? From this man, Pierre Plantard. He was born in 1920, died 6 years ago. Now this guy's a loser, in a way. Here's why. How would you like to be the inventor of an idea that you hope makes you money, and it turns out everybody makes money but you? Well, that's what happened with Plantard. He came up with these ideas, and one French author wrote about them and made quite a bit of money, a guy named Gerard de Savay. And then the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail took Plantard's ideas and made a lot of money. Plantard died in 2000 and basically disgraced himself. We'll talk about that in a second. And he never made any money. Here's three things you should know about Plantard. Now remember, this is the guy who's the main person who started all those theories about Mary Magdalene, Jesus, Sarah, the bones of Mary Magdalene, the prior sign, Leonardo da Vinci. Alright? So here's three things to know about. First, he's convicted several times of fraud through his life. So Dan Brown's getting his ideas from a person who's a fraud. Plantard was making up schemes in the 1950s. That involved fraudulent activity. He served time in jail. His wife left him over some criminal charges related to child abuse. And so he doesn't seem to be a great character to get truth from. Second point, he claimed to be the true king of France. Now what he said is that he was the surviving person, descendant from the Merovian kings, the earliest kings of France. And the Merovians were from Sarah, who was from Mary Magdalene and Jesus. So Pierre Plantard is not only the king of France, but he's one of the sole surviving descendants of the Lord Jesus Christ and his wife Mary Magdalene. Quite a person. Now, no one in French government recognized him as the king. In fact, here's a third point. Plantard was forced to admit in court in 1993 that he made the whole thing up about the secret society. What happened was he appeared before this man, Thierry Jean-Pierre, a famous French judge and former member of the European Parliament. Jean-Pierre was investigating a French politician, sort of the equivalent of Gomery's David, the scandal with the Liberal government in Virginia, and then the commission about it, the Army Commission. And Planned Parenthood offered to give this judge the truth about the politician. This judge thought Planned Parenthood was a little, what shall we say, untrustworthy. So he ordered a search of Planned Parenthood's apartment, and they found all these documents and manuscripts, and then the judge basically got Planned Parenthood to confess to them and the whole thing up. So let's go. The bottom line is, just a couple more things about the prior side. The prior side, the secret society that holds the bones of Mary Magdalene, it wasn't started in 1099 in Jerusalem. It was started in, we'll see the answer here in a second, 1956. Now, if you study historically, you might discover that there was a monastery called the Prior Side in Jerusalem in the Middle Ages. But it has nothing to do with this secret society started by Pierre Plantard. Now, how do we know, let's go to the next slide, how do we know this? Well, you can do research and get copies of the registration forms of Plantard's Prior Side. You can check the date for yourself. I don't know how clear it is on your screen, but see on the left corner there? 7th of May, 1099. Oh, sorry. Almasse is a region of France, 1956, and then the French there is pretty well the same. That's the registration for the secret society. Now, of course, you can always say, well, that was just the registration done in France. It actually goes back earlier. Well, I challenge you to try to find the early evidence of this secret society. Let's go on. You can even see Planetary's signature on the document. He was the Secretary General of the Society. It was originally created just as a social action group. And then in the 60s, Plantard came up with all the conspiracy theories. Let's go on. So bottom line, the theories of the Da Vinci Code are based on the fabrications of a con artist. Now, if you're Dan Brown, would you like to admit that? No. Does Dan Brown care about this? I don't think so. And listen, if your book was translated into 40 languages and you were the most popular adult author of fiction author of all time, and your book's selling 30,000 copies a day, and Tom Hanks is about to star in your movie, do you care about the details about where you might have got it wrong? I don't think so. If things worked out in terms of my hard stuff, I'm hoping to go to the world premiere of the Da Vinci Code in Cannes. I've got pretty good press credentials. And I hope to get a chance to be in some interview. Dan Brown's going to be there, and I'd love to be in a press conference and get to ask the questions. I think my main question would be, does it bother you that your novel is rooted in the work of a con artist named Pierre Plantard, who's been discredited by the French justice system? All right? I don't know how he can answer that. I think if I was him, I would just say, you must be a Baptist from Moncton, New Brunswick. By the way, one thing you need to understand when you study something like this about the name of Pierre Plantard is there are people in the world who are cold-blooded liars who make things up for money, fame, or power. They're called con artists and frauds. Thankfully, we don't meet too many of them. And it's always a lesson in the truth of the Bible about the deception you inherit to meet a con artist. But sometimes we need to realize we deal with people who don't know how to tell the truth and wouldn't know the truth if it hit them. Maybe 4 months ago, I went to a gas station in Pickering where we live, and I got out of the car, and there was a man 5 feet away, and he was standing there with an empty gas tank. And he knew that I would figure out the obvious. What would you think if you saw a man with a gas can at a gas station? You would think he ran out of gas, right? So he says, "Sir, can you help me?" And I said, "What?" He said, "My wife and child are in my car over off the off-ramp on the 401. We ran out of gas, so I was wondering if you could give me some money for gas." Now, is that possible?
Yeah.
Is it possible he's lying to me? Well, I decided to tell him what I often tell him in situations. I said, "You know, I've been a pastor in churches before, and I've had a lot of people rip me off." And you know what he said? I said that to him. You know what he said? "Where two or three are gathered together, there am I in the midst." So we have a man who's got an empty gas can, whose wife and child are over by the 401, and he knows some Bible verses. He said that he was just in Pickering for the first time, and he said, "I just got a job and I'm moving here from Windsor." Okay? So I asked a few more questions. Didn't know for sure what the truth was, but I went inside the service station and I know the manager. He said to me, in words I'll never forget, he said, "What's his story tonight?" I said, "Why?" He said, "He's here all the time. So I just want to know what his story is tonight. Wife and child were over by the 401. He said, "No, he's here all the time." So, what's going on here? It's cold-blooded, calculated lie. And that's what's going on in the Da Vinci Code from Pierre Plantard. I don't think Dan Brown knows that he's wrong. I don't think he's bothered to check out a lot of stuff. And once the controversy started, he said in several interviews, "I'm really glad this has got people taught." What he doesn't realize, by the way, is that he's attacked the faith of millions and millions of Christians. He basically says Catholics and Protestants are a bunch of losers who basically have been fooled because they don't check things out carefully like Dan Brown. And then he sort of implies, like, why are you upset? And the reason we're upset is because he's attacked the basis of Christianity. Okay, let's go on. But Dan Brown says on page 1 of the novel that there are ancient documents in the French library. Surely he didn't get that wrong. Well, here's what happened. The library did not discover ancient documents. That is a falsehood. I think Dan Brown just got his facts mixed up. Here's what actually happened. Pierre Plantard had a friend make up fake documents, and they put those documents in the French library. You and I could start a secret society here in Newmarket. We could call it the Society of the Ex-Cedar View Church Members, and we could say that there's secret documents about Pastor Don in the University of Toronto Library.
I think that's true, but...
Yeah. That's what Plantard did. We even know the name of the man who made up the documents. His name is Philip de Cherisset. And the reason we know that he made them up is because Plantard got Philippe to make the documents, and then he and Philippe told their story to a guy named Gerard de Sade. He wrote a book about it that was a bestseller, but he wouldn't get any of the money to those two. So then Philippe de Cherisset went public and said, "Oh, by the way, Gerard's book's stupid because it's based on a con job. I'm the guy who made up the ancient documents." All right, let's go on. Well, okay. Dan Brown doesn't seem to be doing too well, but what about the panes of glass at the pyramid entrance to the Louvre? Let's go on. I couldn't go check out the Louvre myself, though I've been there. I wrote to Celine Dauvert, who's in public relations at the Louvre, and here's what I wrote her. You can read for yourself. I couldn't believe that I got a reply on this, but I asked her how many panes of glass. And then notice the scholarship, merci. Six, 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 seven, three, six, eight, four. Let's look at her reply. You can read it for yourself.
Six, seven, three.
Now, what Dan Brown says in the novel is that the former French president, François Mitterrand, he's a member of the secret society too. And they like occult stuff in that secret society. So he told the architect of the entrance, the new pyramid entrance movie, I want 666 panes of glass in the front entrance of the movie. But there's no evidence Mitterrand was a member of the society. Dan Brown just based, this is based on a popular rumor in French culture. Let's go on. Where's the novel accurate? Let me just mention a few things. First, it's accurate in noting that the church through history has treated women unfairly. This theory about women being inferior started probably in the second and third century. Augustine added a lot of weight to it, and then it became a dominant view. The novel is also accurate in that, that the church was cruel during the Inquisition against witches. For 400 years, Catholics and then Protestants would attack somebody just by calling them a witch. Now, it's quite an interesting thing that happened, though it's very tragic. It shows, what it shows is the power of rumor, gossip, and then when someone has power to twist things, it's hard to resist it. So what would happen from the year 1400, thereabouts, to 1800? If you didn't like your neighbor, the best way to deal with them was just to say to your priest or your pastor, she's a witch. And then what would happen was you would be your neighbor would be tortured. And it's kind of weird. Here's what power works like. Let's say I pick on Don right now, and I'm the inquisitor, and I say to Don, we've had a report. I hate to say it, but you actually are far more than a pastor. You are a witch. Now, Don, we've got a simple question for you. If you admit that you're a witch, you will die today. If you deny that you're a witch, you will be tortured until you admit the truth. So would you rather die today or the number of days and weeks it takes to torture you to get you to admit the truth that you're a witch? Now, what's the answer? Well, let's say Don's strong and says, no, we'll just keep torturing. And then after weeks and weeks of torture, he'll probably admit it. Now, let's say two people here say right away, our pastor's not a witch, he's a godly man. I heard you were a witch too, sir. See, that's how it worked. And so that kind of oppression created 4 centuries of killing, tragedy. Okay, a third point, the novel's writing noting that the church through history often viewed sex as dirty rather than as a gift of God. Now, I don't think Dan Brown has the right solution here. The solution to a negative view of sex is not going to be remedied by saying, go to church and take your clothes off. And that's where the book, by the way, has evil consequences. In our sex-obsessed culture, that novel is going to draw a lot of people to religion where they're going to get abused in that form of abuse. It's amazing the number of churches and religious groups where the leaders have so much power that they can tell people, I want all your money, I want your brains, and I want your body. And people say yes. The novel is really hurting itself by contributing to that kind of mindset in terms of, say, worship is about sex. But he's right in noting that the church often treated sex as dirty. Let's go on to his last point. The church also made a mistake early on in thinking that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute. That was based on the meal of the Pope in the 6th century. The novel gets the time wrong, but the church didn't make a mistake. Okay, let's go on. We're coming to the end here. Should we trust what the Da Vinci Code says about Jesus and the Gospels? Now, prosts like me were often guilty of not being clear, because we always know the other side of the story. We know all the theories. At least one of my students is here tonight, and some of my co-workers. One of the downsides of Tyndale is sometimes students would get a little, freaked out, upset by hearing all the theories about sex. So I thought I'd make the answer to this simple. Should we trust what the novel says about Jesus in the Gospels? No. Is that plain enough? Of course it's not totally wrong about Jesus. It says he's the greatest religious teacher in history. It says he's a great human being. So, but basically, it messes things up, and let me show you why. There's five big errors he makes about Jesus in the Gospels. Number one, there's no evidence from history that Jesus was a witch who engaged in sex rituals. Now, this idea, when I first read the novel and read this, I could hardly believe that Dan Brown taught it. I know a lot about witchcraft. Studying witchcraft is one of my specialties. I'm friends with some of the world's greatest experts on witchcraft. So I couldn't believe Dan Brown said this. There's no evidence that Jesus was a witch. What he was, as told in the next slide, he was a Jewish teacher who taught with authority, performed miracles, and claimed to be the Son of God. If Jesus had been a witch, the Pharisees would have complained against him by saying that. They said a lot of things against Jesus, but one thing they never said is he's actually a witch. The Old Testament condemns witchcraft. If Jesus had claimed to be a witch, the Pharisees and others who opposed Jesus would have said it. This idea, you know, not all ideas are worthy of thought or worthy of study or worthy of respect. This idea is really one of the wildest theories I've ever read. Okay, let's go on. Here's one of the standard books on witchcraft, edited by Shelley Rabinovich, who's a witch who teaches in Ottawa, and James Lewis, who's a scholar of witchcraft and teaches in the U.S. There's not even an entry on Jesus in this standard reference book. Last June, I was at a conference in Sicily, and for the second time, I met one of the earliest members of the first modern witchcraft group, and that Fred Lamont. And Fred told me how he became a witch and why he loves witchcraft. He never once, in an hour interview, said, "Oh, and by the way, Jim, you thought Jesus was a Baptist, but he's actually a witch."
Baptist.
He knows that Jesus was not a witch. And I've met a lot of witches, and I've never had any of them try to tell me that Jesus was really a person in the witchcraft. By the way, the witchcraft to Dan Brown doesn't mean killing cats on Halloween night. It basically means, think of this, a tree-hugging, nature-loving, sex-adoring pig. And he tried to say that Jesus was a witch, sort of like a New Ager, and he and Mary Magdalene had a thing going on to teach us that God is both male and female, and that sex is the highest expression of worship. Second error, there's no evidence from history that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene. No one says that in ancient history. There's a book called The Gospel of Philip, written in the 2nd century, that says Jesus and Mary Magdalene kissed. But that's all it says. Not even the Gnostic Gospels teach Jesus and Mary. By the way, Dan Brown wants us to think of this. Let's go to the next one. Here's what we believe as Christians. We believe that Jesus lived and died around 38 AD. Then we believe that within 20 years, New Testament writers were writing about it. So Galatians is dated 49 AD. The Gospel of Mark could be as early as 55. Most of Paul's writings come in the 50s and 60s of the first century. And then the whole New Testament is done by the end of the first century. And Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the four Gospels about Jesus Christ. Dan Brown says, no, that's not true. Here's what really happened. Jesus was a witch. He and Mary Magdalene had a thing going on. They loved trees and nature, and they had a baby named Sarah. But this story got crushed. Nobody liked that story in the Roman Catholic Church. But that story is the true one. And so what happened was Jesus lived, he was a witch, and then 325 years later, Constantine said, "I don't like that stuff about Jesus and Mary Magdalene.
and sex in church?
I want you, and he says to Pope, you get somebody to write four new Gospels, and we'll call them Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and we'll crush all the other stories about Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Well, there's no evidence from ancient history that Constantine invented the four Gospels. The Gospels are written 200 and some years before Constantine lived. Let's go on. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written in the first century by disciples of Jesus. Even atheist scholars and secular historians know that to be true. I don't think there's a single Bible scholar or historian who said the novel's accurate. But again, if your novel is selling 30,000 copies a day, it doesn't matter what a few scholars say. In fact, it doesn't even matter if all the scholars in the world disagree, because their books aren't selling 30,000 copies a day. Unless you remember Drusus Sale. Okay, let's go on. Here's a standard history of the Bible, and Constantine is not even mentioned. Why? Because by the time Emperor Constantine becomes a Christian, the Gospels have already been accepted by Catholics and Orthodox Christians. Nobody is debating the reliability of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It's already been settled for at least 150 years. All right, let's go on. There's also no historical evidence for a secret society. I mentioned this earlier. Let's just look quickly at a few things. Was Leonardo da Vinci a member of a pagan sex cult? The answer is no. He was a famous artist, engineer, and asked for Christian burial near death. But Dan Brown would have us think that he actually knows the real truth about Leonardo. He was a famous artist, he was an engineer, but he actually was pretending to be a Christian. He was actually a pagan who was a member of this secret society. He was the head of it. Well, my son is an artist who goes to the Ontario College of Art and Design, so he helped me answer this stuff about Leonardo because he's done research on Renaissance history. And he told me, now at Tyndale, we're not allowed to swear in class. Does that surprise you?
Yeah.
Andrew Smith here is in the IT department. He's so good at technology that he has it all secretly wired so that if we swear, we get immediately reported to the president. Really? I don't know. Andrew's really good. No, we don't swear, but at Ontario College of Art and Design, the profs are allowed to swear and we don't get in trouble. My son said his Renaissance art teacher keeps swearing about Dan Brown. Why? Because he now has to spend his life as a Renaissance art historian answering the famous theories of this novel. So in the class he says, now we've got to talk about the blank theories of Dan Brown relating to Leonardo. And then he says, and he has this blank theory that, and then he goes on. Well, I won't swear, I'll just tell you, I wrote some of the world's leading art historians and asked their opinions about Dan Brown's theories that Leonardo was really into a pagan sex cult and that he had all these secrets embedded in his paintings. Most of the scholars wrote back, and a lot of them didn't want to be quoted. Why? Because they love doing their research and they don't want to get involved in general debates. But every single one of them told me privately something like this: you've got to be kidding. Nobody believes this. And then they said the typical one, it's just a novel. Why don't you take your medicine and relax? And I had to write back and say, I know it's a novel, but it claims that these things about Leonardo are actual truth. And then every person wrote me back and said, well, just for the record, or just between me and you, nobody in the art world believes this about Leonardo. Let's look at a quote from one prof who agreed. When I asked James Beck at Columbia about the idea that Leonardo was the head of a secret pagan sex cult and he did all these secrets in his paintings, he said that's totally nonsense. Let's go on. The myth in the novel is that it's Mary Magdalene next to Jesus in the Last Supper. Fact, everyone in Leonardo's day thought it was the beloved disciple next to Jesus. What fools us in our century is that we see long hair on the disciples, on the disciple next to Jesus in the painting, so we say it must be a woman. We don't understand the way that Leonardo and the artists of his day painted the beloved disciple. But here's another important thing. Let's look at the next slide. Even if Leonardo put a woman next to Jesus at the Last Supper, that wouldn't tell us anything about the real Last Supper. Have you seen what people can do with Photoshop and with computer skills? In fact, if my son just moved and he doesn't have internet access yet, I was going to get him, and he's done this before, I was going to get him to put your pastor's picture in the Last Supper.
That would be good.
We'll do it anyway. Okay, let's go on. The last thing, there's no evidence from history to trust the Gnostic Gospels about Jesus rather than Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The Gnostic Gospels are documents written in the 203, mainly in the 2nd and 3rd century. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. You could buy a book called the Gnostic Gospels. You can go on the internet and read the 80 Gnostic Gospels that we have. Here's what you'll find. There's about 80 of them. They're boring, confusing, and they would never make you think that the writers knew anything about Jesus Christ. If you want to know about Jesus Christ, read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and the rest of the New Testament. If you want to get lost in a fog bank and have something to help you sleep at night, get the Gnostic Gospels. One of the world's leading scholars of Gnosticism said that it looks like Dan Brown deliberately twists so that the Gnostic Gospels are different than they actually are. Now, I don't think Dan Brown deliberately twisted things. I think because he's not a specialist in Gnostic literature, he got lost and just accepted some popular theories. Right, let's finish. The bottom line, Dan Brown has written fiction, nothing more, nothing less. If only he would admit that his novel is just a work of fiction. But until he takes away his claim that it's that what it says about art, architecture, rituals, and the Bible is accurate, then we have to defend the faith. Let's switch to a last question. Should we trust the New Testament about Jesus? Let me just briefly end with this. Then we'll have time for questions. The New Testament, as I said, is written by eyewitnesses who knew Jesus. I mentioned earlier that I studied with a famous atheist named Anton Flew just 2 years ago. Came to the conclusion that there was a God. The reason that he couldn't explain any longer the complexity of the universe as an atheist. So he announced to the world that he'd become a believer in God. He told me once when I studied with him that he actually had a hard time believing that the early Christians knew Jesus, wrote all about it, were willing to die for it, and just made it all up. Now, he told me when he was a student at Oxford in the days of C.S. Lewis, they were taught that the Gospels were written in the 2nd century. And if they're written in the 2nd century, they're by people who don't know Jesus. But he learned when he was a student at Oxford, the Gospels are actually from near the time of Jesus, from people who knew him. So here he is, an atheist, saying, I don't know how they could make it all up. And he told me in an interview just a year ago, that I wrote about his conversion to belief in God, that Jesus is the greatest religious teacher who's ever lived. That's the confession of someone who's been an atheist for 60 years. Next point. Jesus is a real person who's followed as a guide to truth by more people than anyone who's ever lived. In fact, let me give you a tip if you start a cult group. You have to tell people that Jesus is on your side. You will not do well in Newmarket or anywhere in North America or anywhere practically in the world if you knock on people's door and say, hello, we've just started the first church of spiritual brotherhood and enlightenment, and we hate Jesus. No, you've got to say Jesus came to you in a vision or a dream or personally in your bedroom and he's on your side. That's a signal of how great Jesus is. Hindus want him as an avatar, Muslims want him as a prophet, Buddhists respect him as an enlightened teacher. Frankly, every cult group I've ever studied want to have Jesus on their side. That tells you something about the greatness of Jesus. Let's look at the next point. The teachings of Jesus provide moral guidance and they fit with day-to-day reality. My twin brother is a psychotherapist. He spends every week talking to people who are very, very disturbed. He's told me many times, not once in all of his years of therapy has anything that he's ever heard contradicted the way Jesus says reality is and the way people should live. It fits with day-to-day reality. And then lastly, Jesus taught with authority and power over disease and death and often he put away. And the reason we want to stand for the gospel is because the gospel denies these, the novel denies these realities. It paints a Jesus who is obsessed with sex, a Jesus who is not who he claimed to be in the Bible, and therefore we have to stand on the truth here. And you know, I love teaching about the greatness of Jesus as a God. And I'm going to tell you a story to end with. And I'm telling you the story not because I believe that things always work out. I mean, I know from just having I'm going to have an appointment with a heart surgeon in 10 days. And so I know that things don't always work out. There's not always a rosy ending. But I believe that God shows us in life through many things that He's on our side and that He hears our prayers. Let me just tell you what is called the license plate story. And I love telling it because I know it's true, I know the person involved, and I know one of the main people that knows about this. There's a Christian writer named Fred Buechner. He's prone to depression. And he's not Pentecostal. Now why am I telling you that? Because Pentecost, as you know, tend to emphasize miracles. Is that true, Brother Don?
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
And that's a great characteristic. But what that means, though, is that sometimes when you have a Pentecost telling a story, you might have a little bias towards believing the story. In terms of, you know, that's what the Pentecostal is supposed to say. Well, this story is about a guy prone to depression who's Presbyterian. All right? In one of his novels, he talks about a day when he and his wife are crying in their living room. Fred lives in Vermont, and he's very good friends with my brother. And in the novel, he says, I was so overcome with grief about our daughter's sickness. She had anorexia nervosa, was expected to die. Now, I'll tell you the end result. She didn't die. She's doing fine. But in the middle of that darkness, and there's no darkness like the darkness of a parent worrying about a child, Fred's overcome with grief and he leaves the house and goes for a drive. And he stops beside the Vermont road and he's crying and he's prone to depression and doesn't always have the faith he should have. So in the car, he says to God, Lord, if you care about my daughter, just give me some sign so that I can hang on. He opens his eyes, a car drives by, and the license plate on the car says, trust. Now, we don't know for sure that God heard his prayer and sent a car along that said trust on license plate. But I think it's pretty good. And that's how God often answers prayer. Let me tell you the rest of the story. My brother went to see Fred a few years after that story was written. And he goes into his office, and I've been there. And on the wall of his office, there's a license plate that says trust. And Fred says, oh, I know that. My brother says to Fred, oh, I know that story. And Fred says, no, you don't. My brother says, yeah, I do. I read it in your book. He said, well, you actually know only part of the story. After that episode with their daughter, Fred said he and his wife had another crisis with their other daughter a little while later. And they're crying in the living room again. And Fred, prone to depression, not always having faith, cries out again, Lord, could you just show that you care in the midst of this darkness? There's a knock on the door. Fred goes to the door. He looks at a man he's never seen, and the man says to him, "Are you Fred Buechner?" And Fred goes, "I am." And the man says, "I'm the guy who owns the car with the license plate trust. I just brought him and bought a new car and didn't want the license plate anymore, and I just thought I'd bring it over to you." I have an atheist friend of the UFT, so that's a coincidence too.
Yeah.
But I believe that we serve a God who knows our license plates, he knows what's going on in our lives, and he can meet our needs. Let me just end with one more story. My son told me this summer when he was in Montreal, and he said, "Dad," he knows I love these kind of stories. He said, "Dad, I've got a great story for you." So he phoned me back later, and he said, I parked the car at a convenience store. I went inside, and when I came out, somebody had stolen the bike off the back of the car. My son loves his bicycle, and he was really sad, angry, depressed. He went to a friend's house, and my son had a feeling, and I think it was the Holy Spirit. Even Baptists can say Holy Spirit. My son had a word from the Holy Spirit that God wanted to get his bike back. So when Derek told me that he thought he should get his bike back, I said, "Did you call the police?" He said, "No, Dad. Even the Montreal police would know that there's little chance they're going to find the bike." I said, "What did you do?" He said, "I prayed that God would lead me to the bike." Montreal's quite a big city. He got in the car, drove back to the area where the bike was stolen, stopped at a red light. A squeegee tape was at the red light. And my son's not in a good mood, and he said, "I'm not going to give that guy any money." Then he realized that wouldn't be right, would it? That'd be allowing his anger to dominate, and it would be unfair. So he rolled the window down in the car in order to talk kindly to the squeegee kid. The squeegee kid leans on the window and says, "Do you want to know where your bike is?" Derek thought, "What?" And he said, "What?" He said, "I know where your bike is." Derek said, "Get in." And to make a long story short, he has a bike back. How? Because I believe there's God who knows where life is. Now, my son knows that things don't always work out. He has the same bone disease that I have. I have osteogenesis imperfecta, which led to my heart problem. So he knows that life has its dark sides and not everything gets fixed. But he believes that in the end, we're in the hands of God, and there's no safer place to be. And we want to defend the gospel against this novel, because we want the world to know that in the hands of Jesus, in the hands of God the Father, there's no better place to be.
Yeah.
Let's pray, and then we'll have questions. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the opportunity to teach here tonight. May you bless this great church. Bless all who minister here. And we pray that the gospel will spread through the work of this church and in our lives. Bless us as we react to this novel. Give us wisdom and understanding. And may we defend the faith once for all in order to the saints. We thank you for the gift you give to us in Jesus. We pray in his name. Amen. Okay. Don,
if you guys want to ask, if people would like to ask any questions, please feel free to do so. We'll just sit up here. And I'll try and repeat the question. No a real one, but if there's a few questions that you want to ask, that would be good. And what we could do as well now is a series of musicians. Why don't you just come up and sit up here? Because we'll be going fairly soon. And you can just be all ready that way. And actually, you can get ready because we'll take up the offering in a little bit. So if you have a question, put your hand up. Got your stool right behind you.
Okay. And make sure you talk loud, please.
Yeah, I'll try and repeat it. John.
Just wondered if you have confronted Dan in either written or verbal with any of these points that you brought up tonight?
No. I did meet a guy at a conference in Philadelphia in November who went to school with Dan Graham. And I gave him two copies of my book, and one of them was to go to Dan Graham. He was going to try to get there. But when you are as famous as Dan Graham is, you are guarded by other people. So I'm going to try to get an interview with him, but it's very, very difficult. He's given no interviews since the book came out in 2003. And I frankly don't think he really cares. If your book is selling like his, and you're making millions and millions of dollars, okay, just think what it would cost to say the truth. Imagine if you went to the head of Doubleday in New York and said, I realize that my book is basically not true. I want it withdrawn from the market. I mean, actually, I know what would happen. The top guns at Doubleday would say, too bad, you signed a contract. We have the rights to publish. So, now here's the weird thing about the publishing world. They would actually probably say, well, we're going to keep the Da Vinci Code selling, but if you want to write another book saying that that novel is true, we can sell that to the Christian market. Okay, other questions? Yep?
Why do you think there's such a hunger for material that's put up like that?
Okay, one, I think it fits into our sex-obsessed culture. So the themes about, you know, go to church and have sex, I think that really is attractive to some people. It sounds so cool, and what people don't realize is how destructive that kind of religion is. The other thing, people love conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
They love secrets. Now, we all know that there are secrets, but let me tell you my basic view about really, really big conspiracy theories. They get so big they explode. Because they're just too hard to imagine. Remember, in our world, people find it hard to keep secrets. Do you ever hear of a woman named Monica Lewinsky? There, the President of the United States can't have a secret kept. I'm friends with two high-up FBI agents, and they tell me, in the FBI, if you tell more than one person, you've told everybody. Here's another thing. If you meet people who say, do you know there's a secret group called, it's often called the Illuminati. They run the world. And then, you want to hear the most bizarre version of it? There's a woman writer in the States who says that the one world church of the Antichrist is run by, and get ready, some of it won't be surprising, but some of it might, the Pope, the Jews, the Illuminati, the Mafia, these are all together. And Pentecost.
I was going to say Pentecost.
Now, see, Don here is part of it, but he's just pretending.
Not.
Now, folks, here's the trouble with that kind of theory. If you claim to know the secret group that runs the world, and these are like they're connected with the CIA and the Mafia, and they kill people, well, maybe you shouldn't talk about it, right? Because if you know the one group that runs the world and they're ruthless killers, and they also own the satellites used by the CIA, well, they're listening to us talk right now. I was just joking. Okay.
It is like the mentality, though, that the inside scoop, like
right.
Inquiring minds, you know, want to know that the kind of stuff at the grocery store and stuff. It's the same kind of stuff. Get the inside scoop.
Right. Okay. Other questions?
Over here, real loud.
Okay. I just finished reading a book called "Truth and Fiction of the Da Vinci Code."
Yeah.
Familiar with it?
Who's the author?
I think it's a Bart Ehrman, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
He's a historian
from
North Carolina.
Yeah.
And he said at one point that most historians accept that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote the Gospels. He seems to be suggesting that the Gospels were written later on by later followers of Jesus because Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were illiterate and couldn't possibly have written them, therefore they were written by followers later on. And later on, what would be your response to that?
Yeah, I know his book. He's a liberal Bible scholar. I think he gives too much credit to the later writers, the Gnostic writers. I don't find it hard to imagine that, for example, take Luke. If you read Luke, he says in chapter 1 of Luke and Acts that he's writing to give you a history about Jesus. So I don't think Bart Ehrman is giving enough credit to the New Testament. But I understand he has a very liberal view of the Bible. But even he basically says in that book that the Da Vinci Code is not trustworthy as a guide to the way the Bible was created. Dan Brown quotes an Anglican scholar named Martin Percy. He's the only scholar who quotes a novel of the Bible. And I actually know Martin. He wrote and he teaches in England. And he knows Dan Brown personally. And he said Dan Brown actually distorted what he wrote in order to back up the story in the novel. All right, other questions?
Someone's pointing to it.
Okay, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, that's you.
Fran, can't hear you. You've got to be way loud. Fran's question, in case you might have heard, but some didn't, it's where the disciples, Mary Magdalene, where these people were buried when they died. Basically,
that's the answer to that would be we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because the movement Jesus led was not popular at first. And therefore, the Christians are basically, early on, a group of persecuted people who have to flee Jewish authority and Roman authority. And therefore, their burial gets no big attention because they're not the sophisticated elite of the society. So we don't know what happened to Mary, the mother of Jesus, or Mary Magdalene, or most of the disciples who followed Jesus in the first century.
And if we did, we would have turned them all into shrines.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. By the way, one of the reasons I don't trust this secret society stuff is, do you think the people who run the secret society called the Prior Society, who have the bones of Mary Magdalene, let's say you and I ran that society and we knew where the bones of Mary Magdalene were, don't you think we'd like to set up a little tour? The other thing, I have a friend, an Italian scholar named Massimo Intervini. He's actually met Pierre Plantard and testified to me that Plantard is a fraud, and a liar, and a con artist, and also lived in poverty. One of the things that's said about the secret society is not only do they have the bones of Mary Magdalene, but they have all the gold that was in the Jewish temple that was destroyed by the Romans. Now listen, if I was sitting on top of all the gold that was in the Jewish temple destroyed by the Romans, I would do better than have a little apartment in a rundown section of Paris. But see, that's how conspiracy theory works. Plantard must have actually been really wealthy, but if he wanted to meet anybody, he would just be in this rundown apartment. Yep.
Can you contrast the current response that Muslims are having to the Muhammad caricatures to the response that the Christian church or Christians should be having to this book?
Right. Here's the difference. Twofold. Islam has never taught, I know Islam quite well, Sharia law has never taught freedom of speech. And therefore, from Mohammed's time to today, the negativity to criticism of Mohammed is consistent. That's the first thing to say. The second thing would be, the church has been bad in the past in terms of not being open to criticism. So if this was 1,000 years ago, Dan Brown would be burned at the stake. But remember, so would Baptist, and so would Pentecost.
Baptist first.
Yeah.
Let's thank him for coming and sharing with us.
I'll stay down here and be glad to talk to anybody. If you want down and talk, don't be afraid to challenge me. I can handle it. Although my heart is a little better. let me just say it's wonderful to know in life's storms that you're in the hands of Jesus. When the doctor looked at me and Monday at noon and said, you're going to another hospital. He booked another doctor and said, call 911. In 2 minutes, there's five people there and ambulance people. And they kept saying to me, like, are you okay? Are you freaking out? No, it wasn't fun. But you know what? I had a real sense of calm. Why? Because I knew that God cared for me. And when you know that, you can handle those stories.
Amen.
God bless you.
Amen.